Hi, everybody, and welcome to today's TOC podcast. I'm Joe Weichert, chair of O'Reilly's Tools of Change Conference. As I've said before, if you want to see everything we've got going on within TOC, products and events-wise, be sure to visit us at O'Reilly.com/TOC. Today's podcast is brought to you by Publishers Weekly, our TOC event partner. Look for regular TOC coverage and original content on publishersweekly.com and in the print edition. I'm joined today by Bob Pritchett, President and CEO of Logos Bible Software. Bob is a leader in publishing innovation and one of my favorite conference speakers. So Bob, welcome to this TOC podcast.
Thanks, glad to be here.
So Bob, if we could, let's start things off by having you tell us a bit about the direct sales model you've built at Logos. Can you briefly explain how that works?
So we sell direct to our customer base, which tends to be pastors and Christian students of the Bible. We sell through a lot of channels, both in person at conferences. We do phone sales to students at seminaries and Bible colleges. And then we have, of course, a very large e-commerce site and web presence. And there we actually have multiple sales channels, even online, through our one website, selling both through kind of pre-publication sales programs, variable pricing systems, as well as kind of traditional added to the shopping cart purchasing.
So a pretty sophisticated model here, and I didn't realize you had such a strong direct sales force. Do they generate a big chunk of the revenue for you?
It's significant, but it's not a majority of our revenue. Most of our revenue comes in straight on the website, but we do have, phone-based sales, and even, we have field sales reps now in 8 cities around the country. Okay. And that, I think, does a lot for exposure, as well as, they sell well and it covers itself, but they're also, introducing us to a larger audience.
Okay. One of the phrases I heard you use, I think, at TOC a few years ago that stuck with me is this notion of how Logos sells the network rather than selling the book. Can you explain what you mean by that?
So we sell a lot of content in one knowledge domain area. So it's all about the Bible or Bible study. But of course, that's a huge category. Right now, we have about 25,000 different ebooks that we offer. But we don't try to sell just ebooks as individual items. We're trying to sell this kind of tool set of a digital library of books about one knowledge area. And that network effect where the books are tagged to each other, they're interlinked, and they're software tools that help you extract data from hundreds of books simultaneously, that creates what we think of as a network effect in value. Each book you add is not just one more book, but it's this increased network of information you have on one subject area. So that provides a reason for customers to buy from us instead of just on the Kindle or some other kind of electronic page flipper.
Yeah, and so even though you've built this out in a religious vertical, if you will, to me it seems like there's a lot of opportunities for other verticals to sprout up like this where they're selling the network rather than the book, right?
Right. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, obviously, in nonfiction or reference categories, because that's where you can get a lot of synergy by interlinking the data. So scientific, technical, medical, publishing, legal, those are areas where that network effect is important. And if you look at some of the other big, kind of electronic content providers, you might not even think of as ebook publishers, Westlaw, right? I mean, they're selling a network of information about law. They're doing things like abstracting court decisions, building their own metadata, their own key linking system between different records. So there's a lot of value there. But I think as we start to see content, even in fiction, the Harry Potter world, the Star Wars universe, things like that, even though it was at HBO doing Game of Thrones or something, right? Right. You've got kind of content ecosystems that are bigger than just one book, even in fiction.
Yeah. And you've spent, personally, but as well as the organization has spent a lot of time building out this direct sales channel, are there any key lessons that you've learned that you could share with the TOC community as other publishers and content owners look to do the same?
I'm sorry, I had a question there.
Well, I was just saying, you've spent a lot of time building out your direct sales channel. I was just wondering if there are any lessons learned along the way that you could share with the TOC community regarding some of those lessons.
We've learned to talk to the customers a lot. We have forums, we have a blog, we are engaged with the customers on Twitter, and then of course engage with them in person. And I think for us, getting out there and actually meeting customers in person has been really useful. And that's, a weird thing in publishing. I think generally it's been a kind of, we produce it, we throw it over the wall to distribution, and they throw it over the wall to retailers, and then, anonymous people come and buy the books. But we've really built community around our content because the people who buy our content have similar interests and interest in that, and getting that kind of customer contact, even if it's not direct customer sales, but customer contact has been really important to us.
Yeah, I want to go back to two things you just said there because I think they're so important. And at O'Reilly, of course, we've built out a direct channel as well. But I think as I speak with other publishers, one of the things that I keep hearing about is their reluctance to do so. And part of the reason they feel is that they're not retailers, and so they want to let their retailing partners do what they do best. By the same token, I think it's so important to really focus on that community building and giving customers a reason to come to you, which you've done with Selling Network and the other approaches you take at Logos. And I, you know, I guess when I talk to other publishers, I get the impression that they feel that all we have to do is put up a website, and if you build it, they will come, and it's just not that easy, right?
No, it's not. It takes a lot of work and persistence and kind of reputation and brand building out there. I understand why people are reluctant to, you know, to go up against their existing sales channels, but those sales channels are changing. You know, when we started our business, something like 80% of our sales went through Christian bookstores, you know, many times mom and pop, you know, bookstores in all over America, as well as some big chains and buying groups. But over time, that diminished as people started buying content directly over the internet. And those stores, many of them are still here. They're not all gone, but they're selling more physical goods, more gifts, more greeting cards, more, you know, materials you want to touch as you browse. And the content sales are moving online.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of interesting going into bookstores these days, and there's such a broad diversity of other products beyond books themselves, so I totally agree with you. As a reminder, today's podcast is brought to you by TOC's event partner, Publishers Weekly. I'm speaking with Bob Pritchett, President and CEO of Logos Bible Software. So, Bob, Amazon is certainly the 800-pound gorilla, and B&N's ebook sales to date have been decent, but most estimates that I've seen show them with probably less than half of Amazon's market share. So, tough question for you, but do you think anybody can really compete with Amazon at the retailing level at this point?
Absolutely. I'm excited to see the number of retailers who have competed with Amazon, and I'm somebody with an Amazon Prime membership who buys everything I could. If I could get groceries from Amazon with that one-click purchasing, I would.
Yeah.
Except sometimes there's something where I need more information, or I need more data, or I need something that's really merchandised right. And I think that's what the local bookstore did for you, was, you know, the bookshop owner who also liked mystery novels and could tell you you're going to love this. Amazon's not really doing that, you know, reviews and ratings and things like that. So I think there's two issues. One is better merchandising. So one of my favorite websites in the world is cheeseslicing.com, which is a website that has turned into a full-time business for someone just selling cheese slicers, you know, little pieces of marble with a wire.
Wow.
But they know so much about cheese slicers that you feel compelled to buy from them if you're looking for one instead of Amazon. Amazon has hundreds of them at cheap prices, but, you know, they can't tell you which replacement wire you need.
Yeah.
So there's the merchandising aspect. And then there's also, you know, content that doesn't appear on Amazon, right? Where the book is a unit that was very convenient for the distribution models we had for 500 years, but maybe the content you're selling isn't a book. Maybe it's an online subscription. Maybe it's a database. If you look at what Ancestry.com is doing and what Logos is doing, you know, we're selling more and more, both of us, access to a large pool of information and tools related to what you're interested in. You know, those books on genealogy might have been books a few years in the past, but now they're an online database that you're paying for monthly access to with Ancestry. And by re-envisioning that as a database instead of a book, it doesn't go through Amazon's channel anymore. So if you want to buy a lot of the data that Ancestry has, you need to be an Ancestry.com member. In the same way, we're starting to produce unique content at Logos related to the Bible, that it's serious scholarship, it's deep academic work. We have a whole team of people with PhDs on staff doing original research and translation and editing, but we're not turning that into something that is a traditional 250-page book between covers.
Yeah.
So we get to sell it through a different channel.
Yeah, and that's a great lead into the next thing I wanted to ask you about, and that's downward pricing pressure, because, you know, with Amazon's introduction of the Kindle, they sort of set the standard of $9.99 for ebooks. And for the longest time, and even today, a lot of customers complain when the price that they have to pay for a New York Times bestseller or anything that's been published in the last few years is more than $10. And yet I look at how you guys are, again, using this sort of network approach rather than looking at individual titles. And I'm just kind of wondering, I'm figuring you're probably facing less downward pricing pressure as a result of that. Is that right?
Well, I think we're all facing the downward price as, you know, the intermediaries get removed, right?
Yeah.
But And I think depending on the type of book you have, you know, if it's a novel or something like that, maybe the price of a novel is going to drop, you know, and people are not going to pay what they used to for it. But publishers have also been throwing a lot of stuff out into the market that arguably has less value, or where its value was in its format, right? Yeah. I mean, there's books that were available in large print and regular print, and books, you know, successful books that have been turned into the children's edition and the illustrated edition and the annotated edition, or, you know, here's the paperback and here's the value priced edition. You know, those are just different kinds of ways of packaging it in paper. And those things in some ways devalue the content, and they also have, you know, they're trying to, you know, you're increasing your production costs of all the different ways you're doing that. I think that when you're selling something that has real value, you can retain that price. When you're selling something that is just another SKU, just another, I don't care what's between the covers, but it's another SKU I've made, there's going to be pressure on that because there's so much of that out there. Yeah. And so much of a commodity. So I think in some ways, you know, you're going to see prices compress, but you can also, you know, sell in a different way. Ancestry is getting more from me on genealogy resources than I ever paid before because they've provided tools that make that more useful. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I'm not rebuying certain content the way I used to. So I'm saving money not just by lower prices. In some cases, I'm paying more prices, but I'm not buying content again. You know, they talk about the pressure on music prices. Well, on the one hand, the price per song might be getting cheaper, but on the other hand, I don't end up buying it on three different media the way I used to.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So good for consumers there, but not so much for the labels, I guess. But I'm with you because I used to buy the vinyl, and then I got the cassette, and I got the CD, and then you know, you get the MP3, and right down the line there.
Right, but there was cost in each of those platforms as well, and you know they're only taking home, you know, so they sell you that three times for $15 each time.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they're only making a certain margin on each of those. Maybe it'd be better to sell it to you once for $10 where they're able to keep 70% of the margin.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, I guess I think we agree on something here as far as this point is concerned. So I wanted to kind of tell you my philosophy is that I feel like up to now in the publishing industry, we publishers have just benefited from these quick and dirty print to e-conversions. And like you said, it hasn't really cost us all that much to make that conversion. And now we're wondering why the product we're offering, which has arguably less functionality, for example, I can't give you a DRM-protected ebook after I'm done reading it. So it has less value than the print book that I could hand off to you in the future. We're wondering, oh, why are customers looking for lower prices? And I feel that the turnaround is going to happen when publishers start to really take advantage of and think about how their customers could use richer content and present a product that can do things on an iPad, let's say, that they can't do in a print book. And that's where I think customers will start paying more. Do you feel that's true?
I think that's true. I think the danger is getting sucked too much into the enhanced ebook idea.
Yeah.
You know, the publishers are thinking, many of them are thinking about electronic book as yet another format. You know, I had hardcover, I have paperback, and now I have ebook. And when you talk about, you know, going digital, they think that means building an XML workflow that generates the ebook the same day it generates the paperback.
Yeah.
If you say, well, you need to make something digital and iPad enhanced, then they start thinking, well, you know, they all look at that table of elements book or whatever.
Right,
you know,
yeah,
I have to be Steven Spielberg and turn my book into a very expensive multimedia production.
Yeah.
But again, that's just taking advantage of the iPad screen and visuals and audio. It's not really taking advantage of how would I buy a book on chemistry if it was part of this network world of information about chemistry that I'm interested in, as opposed to, again, this kind of standalone one-piece item. So just increasing the cost of producing that standalone one-piece item isn't, I think, going to be a good solution. There'll be a couple, you know, spectacular gift book type, you know, successes. But I think long-term it's, you know, does anybody need a book just of the periodic table, the elements, right?
Right.
That made sense to buy my sixth grader, you know, for science class. But if I'm really interested in chemistry or the elements or geology or whatever, maybe there's a whole different way I'm going to engage that content. You know, maybe I'm going to join a community of people who collect rocks or people who, you know, are interested in this particular aspect of chemistry, and I'm going to have a different relationship. And that's what we're trying to get to in our business. But I think it's very different from what publishing has been doing. And it's going to be hard for people to make that transition and figure out what the new world looks like.
Yeah, I kind of liken it to a pendulum swinging, right? So off on the left side is where publishers haven't put any sort of rich content. It's those quick and dirty conversions I was talking about. Over on the other extreme, on the right side, might be something like the elements, which is just super rich. And like you said, maybe there's a question about, okay, who's the target audience? Who's it really intended for? But I think as the pendulum swings back and forth, it's going to come to this sort of midpoint where publishers are probably going to realize that, you know, let's not just throw a bunch of gratuitous rich content in here for no particular reason. Let's find out what customers really want and what's going to be of value to them, right?
Right. I mean, taking the elements thing again, it's like how many people really want to pay a fixed price for any book just about the elements, as opposed to saying, you know what, I'd pay $14.95 a month through my child's elementary school years to have access to a multimedia homework helper database that had rich media on the elements and physics experiments videos and, you know, all this other data. And that could be a massive content product that represented, you know, 30, 40, 50 books that you might have sold in your traditional model, but instead becomes a subscription product that everybody who's got a kid, you know, from third grade to eighth grade feels compelled to subscribe to.
Yep. So,
very different.
Yeah. So, you know, last question for you, Bob, and you're kind of taking me down this path. You seem to be almost describing Amazon's Kindle lending library program, right? Where as part of Prime, you get access to this vast repository of content. Do you feel like that's the future?
I think there's going to be a mix. My favorite analogy is always, you know, the video industry. You know, you pay $50 a month and you get 400 cable channels, right? Mm-hmm. But then if you want the NFL package, that's $12.95 and you get 8 more channels and some special things. And then if you want, you know, HBO, that's another $12.95 just for that one channel. And yet still, you know, you're going to pay $14 to take your kid to the theater to watch the 3D single movie, right? So I think there will be things at all different price points. But overall, just like, you know, a lot of us are signing up for, you know, $8 a month on Netflix to stream 1,000 movies, I think we're going to see a lot of stuff going into that, you know, just let me pay one price and have access to a library. And it'll have to be something really special to be able to be pulled out as an individual sale.
Okay, so flat price for a big sort of library, but then sort of specialty pricing for these other types of channels almost that you're describing, right?
Right, and it could be time-based. It could be that, you know, the newest stuff is always still sold standalone or whatever. And we're still figuring this out. We don't know how it's going to go. But I think the you know, it's going to change because what we've been doing was really had a lot to do with the physical objects and the physical distribution system, which is really being shaken up.
Right, absolutely. Well, that's all we've got time for today. Bob Pritchett, thanks so much for talking with us on this TOC podcast.
Thank you.